Greetings once again from Denver, Colorado, the city right here in the middle of it all. You may have heard the news. Stand by now for the World View. Welcome back to the show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do focus on the events of the week through the lens of original thought. So good to have you with us this week. And I must confess, I've been in Las Vegas, most of the past week. Not that there's anything to confess, you know, but I found it interesting as I went down into the bowels of the Las Vegas airport. There's a big sign that says, "What happens here stays here," and in parentheses, "just a friendly reminder." And that same sign also greets one when one returns to the terminal there at McCarran International Airport in Las Vegas, Nevada. And I thought to myself as I looked around at the dregs of humanity populating Las Vegas these days, bizarre people with tattoos putting themselves on display as they walk down Las Vegas Boulevard. I thought to myself, what happens in Vegas stays in your bloodstream, at least for a few weeks, possibly for a lifetime. And I'm what I wanted to confess, though, is that I'm suffering from what I've deemed Vegas lung. And I'm not sure what happens, but every time I go to Las Vegas, I return with Vegas lung. It's a condition in which your upper respiratory system feels as if it's wrapped in wet leather and the leather is slowly drying. But hopefully we'll get through the broadcast. So anyway, I'm out in Vegas. I'm looking to make some money. I'm trying to find some work out there. And I was greeted as I walked through the casino at the Fabulous Flamingo, a fabulous hotel. I was greeted by a couple of ATM machines, above which was a large marquee that read Banking Center. And I thought to myself, this is good. If I'm able to make some money out here, at least I'll have a place where I can come and do my banking right here on the casino floor at the Fabulous Flamingo in fabulous Las Vegas, Nevada. Interestingly enough, there were no deposit slots at the Banking Center on the floor of the casino there at the Fabulous Flamingo. But the thing about Vegas these days, how do I put this? I mean, there's too many Euros, too many homos, and too much air conditioning. I mean, I got into my hotel room the first night and laid back on the bed. I'm phoning, checking in with my extremely attractive audio engineer and the girls. And I noticed that I was shivering 5 minutes into the call, and I checked the little control there on the wall for the temperature, and it was set at 65 degrees. And anyway, I set it at 72 because I thought 65 was just ridiculous. It's as if the hoteliers in Las Vegas want to declare their power over the environment, because it was like 102 degrees outside. And then I was working over at Caesars, and Everyone at the event was freezing. The women were all wrapping themselves, looking for a tablecloth to wrap themselves with. They were so cold, they're just shivering and freezing. And I'm not sure why they do that in Las Vegas. Funny thing, at Caesars, all the trash cans have a logo on them that says Caesars is green. they apparently recycle all their garbage. And apparently that makes them feel better about setting the temperature in the hotel at 65 degrees when it's 100 degrees outside. But, you know, they're green there at Caesars. Was there anything else interesting in Vegas? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe we might get to something. But let's start, as we are often wont to do. We'll start with a story from the Kansas City Star from Overland Park, Kansas. Two 21-year-old men were drinking and arguing about a band. when one of them grabbed a knife and a frying pan and attacked the other. Police say that the man who was attacked happened to be holding a banjo and defended himself with said banjo. They say that a banjo blow to the head stopped the man with a knife and a frying pan. the smell of alcohol was prevalent, according to police. Now, there's no word on what band was being argued about. And there's no word on if either of the men actually played the banjo or played it well. But banjo has been successfully used as a tool of defense there in Overland Park, Kansas. And this reminds me of an incident that is legendary, at least in my own mind. An incident that occurred when I was in junior high school, somewhere around 1978, 1979, fifth or sixth grade, my family in the late 1970s fled the socialist utopia of New York State and moved down to West Texas and enrolled all of us hapless children in the public school factory down there, which rapidly turned into a daily torture chamber for my brother and for me, as a matter of fact. And so I'm in fifth grade, or sixth maybe, and a band called Kiss, if anyone is familiar out there, a band called Kiss was playing in Odessa, Texas, and the buzz on campus there at the public school factory was all about the Kiss concert, and one's social status was basically determined by who was going to the Kiss concert and who was not going to the Kiss concert. And if you spent any time around the McBurney household circa 1978, the one thing you knew was the McBurney boys were not going to the Kiss concert. And I had an opportunity to chat with a fellow there, one of the leaders of the torture crews at the public school factory there. And I posited the notion that Roy Clark was a better guitar player than the guitar player for Kiss, whose name I did not know, and as a matter of fact, as of this moment, I cannot recall. Can you recall?
Ace.
Ready? Ace.
Oh no!
Oh no! That's kind of embarrassing that you knew it right off the top of your head. Okay, so I am at the time I was a music fan. As I remain today, and I always appreciated great guitar players, and I have to admit at the time I was not familiar with the technical abilities of one Ace Frehley, but I felt comfortable because I was very, very familiar with the guitar stylings of Roy Clark, and I felt confident that even though I had never heard a lick by Ace Frehley, that I had the better side of the argument, that Roy Clark was indeed a better guitar player than Ace Frehley. Anyway, that one conversation, either in the fifth or sixth grade, led to years of ostracization within the community there, all through high school, despite the fact that at the end of the day, I was correct, that Roy Clark was and is, if he's still living. I hope Roy is still living, and I hope Ace is still living. But my guess is, even if Ace practiced every day since 1978, he's still not as good as Roy Clark on a bad afternoon in a low rent bar. All right. So anyway, I don't know why that room. Oh yeah, they were arguing about a band. So anyway, if you have any thoughts, or if you can send me some audio of Ace Frehley out licking Roy Clark, I'd be happy to repent of my position. But as of right now, I believe that history will bear out that I was indeed correct. All right, now let's move on to serious news of the day. We're going to go to the war from the war file. I wasn't sure whether to file this in the foreign or the domestic war file, but I think it makes it into the foreign war file. Dateline Tehran. Two Iranian grand ayatollahs have issued fatwas calling for the killing of those who insult the Quran, including anyone who burns the Quran. Big surprise there, right? Let's see. They say that such an action against any individual could only be carried out with the authorization of an Islamic religious judge. You'll all remember that a pastor from Florida had planned to burn the Quran on September 11th. You remember Terry Jones of the Dove World Outreach Center there in the Orlando area. He had planned to burn them, but he has acknowledged now that he received more than 100 death threats, but he says he was not scared into calling off the burning of the Quran. Now me, 100 death threats from wild-eyed Islamists, I would probably admit that, yes, I'm scared. I'm not going to burn the Quran. I would probably find another way to witness to our lost brethren, but I would admit that, yes, they scared me. Why? Well, because when they say they're going to kill you and cut your head off, they have a tendency to carry through on that threat. Those wild-eyed Islamists do. And so, I don't know, if Mr. Jones must be some kind of superhero type if he wasn't scared. But now the fatwa has been issued, so that if you're out there thinking about, and I'm not just burning the Quran, they say anyone who insults the Quran, which I suppose that would be to debate a Muslim about the contents of the Quran and the spiritual and historic relevance of the Quran. I suppose if you were to debate that with a Muslim, you'd probably be in danger of having your church firebombed and having your head cut off. And so the religion of peace continues to spread its peaceful message throughout the world by threatening to kill anyone who insults their allegedly holy book. Uh-oh, I probably shouldn't have said that. I could be in trouble already. All right. All right, now let's move into the justice file. Just in case you were getting a little bit depressed about the state of justice and crime in America, we have this story from CNN. The FBI is reporting that crime dropped again in 2009. They say crime has dropped for the third straight year. And now, when you look at violent crimes, there are only 430 offenses for every 100,000 individuals living in the United States. Isn't that wonderful? Nationwide, more than 1.3 million violent crimes were reported last year. We don't know how many were unreported. And also, we don't know how many of each of those 100,000 people, how many of those are, let's say, under the age of 10 years old and probably not in a position to commit a lot of violent, heinous crimes. But I suppose it's fewer and fewer every year, right? Let's see. Law enforcement officials made roughly 13.7 million arrests last year, and officials did not release an estimate for hate crimes, which are compiled for a separate report to be released later. Apparently, these are all the love crimes. These are all the friendly crimes, the friendly assaults, robberies, manslaughters, things of that nature that fall into the love crime category. And we'll find out about hate crimes a little bit later in the year, and I'm sure we'll all be on the edge of our seat waiting for those. Now, from the Domestic Tranquility File from Baltimore, Maryland, the AP reports, a man who became distraught as he was being briefed on his mother's condition by a surgeon at Johns Hopkins pulled a gun and shot and wounded the doctor, then killed his mother and himself last Thursday. The fellow was 50-year-old Paul Warren Partis. We have a quote here from Partis's brother. Partis's brother says, "I guess my brother just couldn't bear to see her the way she was." And apparently the mother suffered from arthritis and rheumatism, and Mr. Partis's postmodern problem-solving skills led him to believe that murder-suicide was the way to solve the arthritis and rheumatism problem of mom. This apparently Mr. Partis was not participating in the drop in crime, at least for 2010, and of course figures aren't out yet on 2010, but I can bet you that the FBI will record that crime is down in 2010 as well, and we can all go on about our business feeling pretty darn good about the state of America. Meanwhile, from NBC in Miami, An 87-year-old Miami man who suspected his 84-year-old girlfriend of cheating on him has been charged with her murder. Juan Adolfo Gonzalez killed one Salida Hernandez. He took a taxi to her apartment last Friday and waited for a bus to drop her off from a senior dining hall. When Hernandez arrived, Gonzalez shot her twice, then turned the gun on himself. The woman died from her injuries, but this pathetic 87-year-old slob managed to live and is currently in hospital suffering with non-life-threatening injuries, unfortunately. He has admitted to the shooting. He has admitted to the shooting, but no doubt there will be a long, drawn-out trial and a number of appeals before the 87-year-old murderer dies of natural causes in prison. Now, you can bet that this particular song was actually playing in the background on somebody's boombox while I was arguing my case for Roy Clark's guitar superiority. It's got to be about the same time frame, wouldn't you think? All right. So we're on into the Domestic Tranquility File, where we will be chronicling the drop in crime here for 2010. Let's go to Everett, Washington. Prosecutors in Washington say an 18-year-old woman stabbed a 19-year-old man for teasing her that her feet smelled. The man was found by police with a steak knife sticking out of his back. Officials said he will recover. Dallas Amber Smith was drinking and hanging out with friends and was challenged to do a backflip. When she took off her shoes to do the backflip, the gentleman started teasing her about the stench of her feet. Well, and there's no report from witnesses as to whether or not the teasing was deserved. We don't know how bad the feet stunk. But she faces charges of second-degree assault with a deadly weapon. Again, a number of years ago, problem-solving skills may have indicated to someone to depart from the scene and wash their feet. But now, in the midst of the dropping crime rate, she whips out a knife and stabs him in the back over stinky feet.
What is the deadly weapon?
Well, no, the deadly weapon was not her feet. The deadly weapon was a steak knife,
okay.
Apparently. Yes. Now let's move on as we chronicle, because you're going to get a report next year on how crime dropped in 2010. So we want to make sure that we chronicle that precipitous drop in crime right here on the Weekly Worldview. Who is this, Jill? Marcos Cuevas is 32 years old, and he's a 295-pound high-risk sex offender, ex-con. He served nearly a decade behind bars. This is from the New York Daily News, by the way. He served nearly a decade behind bars for raping two women in 1996. He is currently charged with rape, burglary, predatory sexual assault, sex abuse, and unlawful imprisonment. Wow, I almost couldn't get that out in one breath. Cuevas was released from prison most recently back in November of 2009. Apparently not in time to participate in the 2009 drop in crime. He had to make his contribution here in 2010. What did he do? Well, the victim's name is being withheld due to the nature of the crime. But it's a 73-year-old woman. She ran into Cuevas in a hallway last Sunday while chatting with her 76-year-old friend. She says he was sweating and he asked me for a glass of water and some napkins to wipe his sweat. So this kindly 76-year-old woman, she invited him into her living room, gave him a glass of water, gave him a rag to mop his sweaty brow with. And Cuevas then told the pair he had a gun and ordered them into the bedroom. He tied the two women, 75 and 76 years old, He tied the two women with the blouses that they'd had on. He put the rag he was wiping his sweat with in one of the women's mouth. He said, and they cried, and they said, don't do anything to us. But he did do something to them. One of the women, during the assault, managed to free one of her hands and grab a Bible. And she screamed, don't hurt us, and God will forgive you. She say the words rocked Cuevas, who literally stopped in his tracks, jumped up from the bed, pulled up his pants, and dropped to his knees, begging for forgiveness. And he took the money he had in his pocket and threw it toward the women before he ran away. Just a mention at the sight of a Bible and the mention of God freaked this terrorist out. He screamed, I'm on drugs, and he whined, I'm sorry, don't call the police, it'll embarrass my mother. The 76-year-old victim says, quote, he could have killed us, even the sickest, but even the sickest perverts believe in God. God saved us, unquote. Now, this is an example where, yeah, God saved her. She mentioned God's name, and this dirtbag just freaked out. Anyways, he is back in custody, but unfortunately will not be introduced to God anytime soon, although he well should be, as anyone with a lick of sense knows. All right. Now, let's move further into the domestic tranquility file. From the Associated Press in Placerville, California, a Northern California teen accused of killing her mother has reached a deal. She's made a deal. A deal that will have her pleading guilty and then testifying against her former boyfriend. 15-year-old Tyler Witt and 20-year-old Stephen Culver are accused of killing Witt's mother, Joanne, in their El Dorado Hills home last year. The mother had accused the boyfriend of statutory rape. Tyler Witt, the daughter who killed her mom, will plead guilty to first-degree murder with special circumstances of lying in wait and killing a witness. But she's agreed to testify against the boyfriend. Once she does that, prosecutors will drop the special circumstances and reduce the murder charge to second degree. Witt will likely be sentenced to about 15 years to life instead of 25 years to life. The boyfriend has pleaded not guilty. And they both, well, they're both participating. Well, they chose not to participate, apparently, in the drop in crime that the FBI reported. I just want to remind people out there that on Judgment Day, the creator and judge of all the universe will not be making any plea deals. He won't be having you testify against anyone else. And he will be handing down sentences swiftly. So please be prepared. Please take the proper precautions. One more from the Justice File. This is an update on a story we covered several weeks ago. You'll remember that some of the peaceful hippies out there in California, who they don't wash their hair and they just want to be friends with everybody and get stoned and eat Ben and Jerry's and work at medical marijuana dispensaries. That's all they want. They're just peace-loving, friendly people. Yes, they might smell, they don't shave, they don't work very hard, but that's all they want is a friendly, passive life. And you'll remember that a couple of them were shot, one murdered there at a pot dispensary. From the AP now, L.A. police have arrested a second suspect wanting the killing of an employee at a medical marijuana dispensary. Arrested was Raymond Easter last Friday afternoon. The victim, 27-year-old Matthew Butcher, was working at Higher Path Holistic Care back on June 24th when at least two suspects entered looking for marijuana and cash. Uh-oh. That's a disruption of the pothead's dream of peace, love, and a relatively light workload at the medical marijuana dispensary. We forgot that there might be criminals come in looking for marijuana and cash and not wanting to party, dude. They didn't want to party. Now, the victim and another employee were ordered by these not-so-friendly criminals to lay face down on the ground, and while they did not resist, both were shot anyway, and Butcher died from his injuries. So, now, we know that the legalization of marijuana across the country is going to lead, as we've been told, to a precipitous drop in the crime rate, because all these stoner potheads will no longer be arrested for possessing small amounts of marijuana. My question is, how many people in L.A. were getting arrested for possessing small amounts of marijuana anyways? I mean, do you think it was a lot? I have a feeling it was not a lot, but that's just my gut. But how many Mexican mafia and MS-13 types are going to make sure that the competition, well, let's just say that the competition, they want the competition in check when it comes to the marijuana business. And all the friendly hippies who have dreams of opening their own dispensary. Well, anyway, they just might want to be prepared for the business competition in that particular line of work. All right, one more from the Domestic Tranquility File. As we chart the precipitous drop in crime, as documented by the FBI, from Rising Sun, Indiana, a teenager who strangled his 10-year-old brother joked around with his mother the following morning and later went into his father's bedroom with a knife and fought the urge to cut his father's throat. That's according to video testimony presented at the young lad's trial last Friday at his sentencing hearing. A video played at the hearing showed an emotionless Andrew Conley describe in detail how he strangled his brother, Connor, dragged him to his car and stuffed him in the trunk, and how he stood over his sleeping father with a knife and fought the urge to stab him. Andrew Conley, the murderer, is now 18, unexpectedly pleaded guilty last Monday to murdering his brother as his trial was about to begin, and he faces 45 years to life in prison, but he cannot be put to death under California law because he was only 17 when the slaying occurred. So he cannot be put to death. His brother, Connor, however, had no such legal protection and indeed was put to death there in California. So someone should let the judges there in California that just because they won't put someone under 18 to death doesn't mean that other people won't. And in fact, they're setting a poor example for people like Andrew Conley, who are obviously mentally deranged and need the fear of God struck into their heart by the justice system in order to prevent this type of thing. The killer's mother said Andrew seemed fine when she arrived from home from her overnight shift at a casino, and that he told her his younger brother was at his grandparents' house, but the boy's body was actually lying in a shallow grave not far from the home. She said that the murderer joked around the following morning and seemed calm, watching movies with her and eating popcorn. No doubt what he'll be doing for the next 45 years or so as he's in prison. But worry not, because he will have a date with justice at some point in the not-too-distant future. I know 45 years seems like a long time for an 18-year-old, but it'll go by relatively quickly. And then Andrew Conley will indeed face justice and will not be able to take advantage of lax sentencing rules. All right. I just can't take any more from the Domestic Tranquility File. Is there anything else that we can move? Oh, here we go. From the Real Science File, from the Reuters Wire, scientists have determined that bats develop dialects depending on where they live, which can help identify different species. I'm talking about bats. Yes, the ugly little creatures that looks like a flying rat with black leather wings. Bats. Yes. Scientists have long suspected that bats had distinctive regional calls, as studies have shown with some other animals. But this is the first time it's been proven in the field. The science project was conducted by scientists from the Forest Science Center, which is a unit of the state government and body industry and investment there in Australia. And researchers from the University of Wollongong and the University of Ballarat, which may or may not be in Australia, maybe in Thailand, I don't know. Anyway, bats use their calls to navigate and hunt using a process called echolocation, in which high-frequency ultrasounds, inaudible to the human ear, hit objects and echo back and basically tell the bat where he's going and how to avoid hitting stalactites, stalagmites, and other things. So this is evolution, ladies and gentlemen. For those of you in the audience that are educating your children and bringing them up in the fear and admonition of the Lord and having a respect for true science, don't overstate your case, because evolution does occur. If a bat is moved from northern Australia to southern Australia and starts hanging out with the southern Australian bats, Well, he's likely to develop a twang, you know what I'm saying? As opposed to the rapid, fast talk of Northeasterners. So the bat will develop a regional accent. So evolution does occur, for all you young people in the audience. Evolution does occur. What does not occur is undirected transspecial evolution. And so I have a 9-year-old daughter who often comes in contact with little heathens from the public school factories in the neighborhood. And we're working on her memorizing that term. Undirected transspecial evolution does not occur. But evolution does occur. And I encourage her to give her little heathen friends examples of evolution like this, but never overstate your case and say that evolution does not occur. But make it clear and take your stand and let your children know where to draw the line. It's the Weekly Worldview. I'm your host, Doug McBurney. Now, Stevie Vai, him I might put up against Roy Clark. I might put Stevie Vai up against Roy Clark. But it would be a contest.
That's not Vai, is it?
Yeah, Steve Vai. Yeah. You don't recognize that? Anyways, now that's really embarrassing to not recognize Steve Vai, but to know Ace Frehley off the top of your head, man.
I know.
That's bad. Anyway, it would at least be a contest, and Roy Clark could give Stevie Vai a run for his money, whereas Ace Frehley would just walk out of the room with his head facing his hands, just embarrassed. All right, I wonder where that kid is now. I'm going to have to look him up on Facebook, that little punk, that wretched little bastard punk who tortured me and my brother for a good, from 5th grade right on through to 11th grade. Before he graduated, and I'm sure took some dead-end job, married an extremely ugly woman, and gained 200 pounds. That is not very nice, I know.
He might be pastor.
He could be. Perhaps he's a pastor in a church, and he's a fundamentalist. And perhaps we could be friends now. I'll have to look him up on Facebook, see if I can find him. Because in reaching back through my memory banks, trying to remember the name of the guy who played guitar for Kiss, I remembered this little punk's name.
More than Ace.
Yeah, I couldn't remember Ace, but this little punk who tortured me for 5 or 6 years, I remembered him.
Yeah.
Now, this little punk didn't torture me all by himself. He led a pack of, like, Lord of the Flies scum in the public schools and tortured me and my brother because we were Yankees from New York. That didn't help. Anyway, I wish homeschooling had been in fashion when I was in 5th grade. That's all I've got to say. All right, now let's move on. Out of the domestic tranquility file, out of the justice file, because I just can't take it anymore. Now, there were a myriad other stabbings, shootings, clubbings, beatings, punchings, draggings that happened all over the country, and we could spend the rest of the show documenting this precipitous drop in crime that we're all living through. But we have to move on because we'll get so depressed and angry that we just won't be able to enjoy ourselves. So let's move on into the politics file, which is always good for a few laughs, even though it can be quite disconcerting at times. From the politics file from the McClatchy News Service in Florida, Governor Charlie Crist has affirmed his support for civil unions, adoption by homosexual couples, and doing away with the military's ban on openly gay soldiers, and says he plans to kiss a man during his next press conference. No, wait a minute. I made that last part up. He doesn't plan to actually kiss a man. But in every other way, he's very supportive of men buggering each other and sodomizing and violating one another and transmitting disease. Anyway, he's in support of all that. He thinks it's just wonderful. Now, Chris, Democratic opponent for the Senate, not to be outdone, one Kendrick Meat, Democrat, says that Chris's homosexual conversion is too little too late, stating he plans to marry a man before the election. Oh, wait a minute. I made that last part up, too. Meek, Kendrick Meek, does not actually plan to marry a man before the election. He's not willing to go that far. See, he's willing to tolerate others and encourage others to destroy themselves and others with a destructive lifestyle, but he's not willing to do it himself. I made that up, to try to make a point, I guess. Let's see here. Now, one of Christ's advisors in the campaign, one Eric Johnson, he says, regarding Christ's late conversion to the support of sodomy and AIDS and self-destruction, better known widely as being gay, advisor Eric Johnson says of Chris's homosexual conversion, he says it's never too late to support gay rights, unquote. Johnson immediately pointed out that he is not romantically involved with Chris in any other way, not that there would be anything wrong with that if they were, just to be clear. So there's your update on the Florida governor's race. What a circus that is. Anyway, Marco Rubio... Yeah, I mean, if Marco Rubio, he should get on his knees and just thank God, thank the good Lord above, that the people he's running against are just flaming pagan heathen scum, and that there's still a good contingent down there in Florida who, well, while they may not be theologians, they know one thing: they don't like queers. All right, hey. I mean, there's certain things we'll tolerate, all right? I mean, if you got stinky feet, hey, you know, we're not going to make a federal case out of it. But we don't like queers, okay, down here? All right? So, Marco Rubio, very thankful to be in the race with, men that love men loving other men, but don't actually love men themselves, if that makes any sense. Now, let's move on into the politics file. The Value Voters Convention has taken place. The Values Voters Convention, by the way, has become a bit of a misnomer because they happen to let politicians speak. And I don't know where they get off calling it the Values Voter. Anyway, they vote. They have a straw poll every year. And this year, I forget who won. I think it was Mike Pence won. Huckabee came in second. And Mitt Romney came in third with under 100 votes. By the way, for all of you Republicans out there, it's my prediction that Mitt Romney will never be elected so much as HOA secretary in the rest of his political career. Now that he's been exposed by real conservatives, they bagged his act back in 2007. I mean, those of us who were paying attention. So Mitt, just get out, man. Get a real job, buddy. It's over. Boy, I hope I'm right about that. If that turns out to be wrong, I'm going to be devastated. Anyways, now the values voter, who was speaking was Phyllis Schlafly here in this article from WorldNet Daily. Phyllis Schlafly, who WorldNet Daily calls the godmother of conservatism, she spoke and she said, this year could be the most important election of our time. And folks, that's one of the most hackneyed phrases I've been hearing that since I was 15 years old. And I'm sure it's been being said since 1789. This year is the most important election of our time. That's what they say every 2 years. And that, you know, Phyllis, come on. I mean, couldn't you come up with better material than that? I mean, for crying out loud. It's not like you haven't been in this game for a while. Phyllis is 80-some-odd years old. Anyway, Phyllis took to the lectern and urged voters at the Value Voters meeting, or Voter Values, I don't know what it's called. She urged them to choose their candidates with more than care, with more care than usual this November. More care than usual, she urged. And here's what she had to say in her great wisdom, ladies and gentlemen. The woman WorldNet Daily calls the godmother of conservatism. She said, quote, "When you think about an election, you have to realize first that somebody is going to be elected. And secondly, that Jesus is not on the ballot," unquote. All right, now, did anybody get that? Do you understand what she just said there? In other words, what Phyllis Schlafly said is exactly what she's been saying for the better part of 40 years. She's saying it's okay to compromise on social issues and vote for politicians in direct opposition to Jesus Christ and the values that he has taught you and your children. It's okay, especially in the case of senators, for the sake of the Supreme Court. She went on to talk about how important it would be to put Republicans in the Senate so that our values and the values of Jesus Christ could somehow be expressed and supported in the Senate confirmation hearings of Supreme Court justices. Phyllis. Phyllis, grab your walker. Come on over here, dear, because we love you. And we know that you tried to make a difference over the last 75 or 175 years that you've been doing this, that you've been advising Christian conservatives. We know that you tried to make a difference. And no doubt, Phyllis, you have made a difference. And we are thankful. Now, please get out. Just get out, Phyllis. Phyllis, your day has passed. Your philosophy has failed, Phyllis. And we all recognize it. Please let someone one-third your age with one-tenth of your salary and three times your wisdom take your place. Phyllis, your compromise has paid you well in money. But in results, Phyllis, in results, you've been found wanting. And I think it's time that someone shopped Phyllis around to a decent home. Not to put too fine a point on it. All right, now, let's move on through the politics file. Apparently, there were some problems. There was a primary vote in the great state of New York, the state that my family fled in 1977, just as the socialists were finalizing the capture of all things in New York. There was a primary in New York City, and according to CBS News in New York, there were major problems at the polls on primary day, and it's all connected to the debut of the state's new electronic voting machines. Now, this I don't understand, ladies and gentlemen. How is it that we can have a network of approximately 5 million ATM machines all over the country, and they never lose my money? I mean, the buttons I hit always reflect exactly what I meant. They never roll me out an extra $20 bill. How is it that we can have this network of ATM machines and about a billion and six laptops all talking to each other, but we can't make an electronic voting machine that works? How is it that that happens? Well, there was major problems. Major problems. Many polling stations opened as much as 4 hours late, and thousands of people may have been unable to cast their ballots in the primary election there in New York. And Mayor Michael Bloomberg has called it a royal screw-up and, a quote, "it's completely unacceptable," unquote. Meanwhile, Charlie Rangel was seen smiling like a Cheshire cat as he ducked out the back of a polling place, winning his primary in the midst of the voting chaos, despite the fact that he's been exposed as basically a low-rent crook who's been stealing money and buying nice cars and going on fancy trips. Charlie Rangel managed to win his primary, and oddly enough, there were some issues with the electronic voting machines. Very strange. Strange things there in New York. All right, let's move on. We have more from the politics file. This is interesting. From Cuba, the Reuters wire, Cuba will lay off more than 500,000 state employees by March of 2011 and expand private employment in the biggest shift to the private sector since the 1960s. They say eventually more than 1 million jobs will be cut from the government payrolls, and they're not gonna replace those with new openings there in the state sector. Now, keep in mind, according to Reuters, and I believe this is accurate, more than 85% of the Cuban labor force, over 5 million people, work for the Soviet-styled one-party state, and many of them, this is amazing that Reuters admits this, many of them work in unproductive jobs. Raul Castro said, quote, "Our state cannot and should not continue maintaining companies, productive entities, services and budgeted sectors with bloated payrolls and losses that hurt their our economy." That's Fidel's brother Raul. This is amazing. I mean, unless this is all a feign or a feint, I mean, it sounds like Raul has looked around and maybe has figured out that communism doesn't work. I know he's a little late to the party, but I mean, we'll take what we can get, right? These poor people in Cuba have been languishing down there for the better part of 50 years, better part of 60 years, for crying out loud. Anyway, Reuters calls this, Raul Castro calls this, the biggest shift to private enterprise since all small businesses were nationalized back in 1968. Raul says, "We have to erase forever the notion that Cuba is the only country in the world in which people can live without working." I agree, Raul. Let's leave that label to Buffalo, where it belongs. Another guy put up against Roy Clark, right? Now, this guy's name is Eric Johnson, but that's not the same Eric Johnson who is threatening to kiss Charlie Crist down in Florida. Let that play for a second. Worldview, and I'm your host, Doug McBurney. We're rounding third, and we're headed for home. Welcome aboard. Let's dive now further, deeper even, if that's possible, into the politics file. This is just up off WorldNet Daily, a shocker. Now, this is shocking, even when you consider the source here. President Barry Ho, also known as Barack Hussein Obama, quoted the Declaration of Independence at the 33rd annual meeting of the Congressional Hispanic Conference. I'm sorry, Congress, Conference, whatever. The Politburo there of Hispanics and Latinos. Yeah. So the Hispanic Congress had their 33rd annual meeting. They had all their lowriders pulled up there at the Capitol. You know, they're comparing chrome wheels and paint jobs. That was playing in the background. Anyway, Barry Ho. That was low ride, duh. I'm just trying to give you the atmosphere, the ambiance of the 33rd annual meeting of the Congressional Hispanic Congress. Barry Ho, during his speech, quoted the Declaration of Independence, and I believe we have audio that may or may not be real. Here's what Obama said. "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed with certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Unquote. That's Barry Ho quoting the Declaration of Independence. So did anybody catch that? Let me read the actual quote. "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So Barry Ho left out the creator. He left out that part. You remember that, you know, Michelle Obama, Barry Ho's M.O., as I like to call her, M.O., she advised us before the election that we would need to change our history, and Barry is working on it. This is the kind of thing, to me, this is an impeachable offense. For the President of the United States to misquote the Declaration of Independence in public, or in private for that matter, I mean, he should be drummed out of office as an incompetent buffoon. And I don't think it was a mistake, although I'm certain that there will be a young staffer to fall on their sword here in the next 48 hours, if anybody even cares. I doubt anyone in the media outside of WorldNet Daily will even mention the fact that Barry dropped the creator from the Declaration of Independence. So let's just move on into the culture file. According to CNN, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert have set October 30th as a date for their Politico comedy rally on the Mall in Washington, D.C. Apparently, Jon Stewart announced his plans for a rally to restore sanity on his show last week. He's also calling it the Million Moderate March. Stephen Colbert, not to be outdone, plans his rally, the March to Keep Fear Alive. That's all going to be October 30th. Stewart, according to officials, indeed has reserved a spot on the National Mall for the big Politico comedy rally from Messrs. Colbert and Stewart. Yeah. Now, the website logos and icons created for the Colbert-Stewart rallies mimic Glenn Beck's Restoring Honor rally using identical typography and similar stylized images. Now, let me be the first to say that I'm certain that Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert have a very talented and witty staff of writers. Let me be the first to admit that. And I would say that Stephen Colbert himself tends to be witty upon occasion. This fellow Jon Stewart, I don't watch him, I don't know. It seems to me that he was part of some really lame music TV thing maybe 20 years ago. Anyway, I can't recall, but I know that something happened in his career after which I could no longer watch him on television, and it wasn't even political. But I know they have a talented staff of writers. And, well, I guess I just want to tip my hat to Glenn Beck. I mean, you know that when your enemy seeks to mock you through backhanded a backhanded impersonation, I guess we could call it, well, you know you've achieved some modicum of success in at least ticking off the enemy. And, well, let there be no doubt that Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert are the enemy of civilized America continuing. You know, they've got the country laughing their way straight to hell. And, oh, well, and there you go. So now they're mimicking Glenn Beck. And I think Glenn Beck drew about a half million, maybe 600,000. I mean, I would say that these Comedy Central bozos would be lucky to get 100,000, which is not a bad crowd, don't get me wrong. I doubt they'll get 50,000. But we shall see, shall we not? Of course, they're going to promote it on their massive network there at Comedy Central. We'll just see how that goes. All right. Now more, on the other side, from the opposite end of the universe, let's go to Helena, Montana. The Republican Party in Montana wants to make homosexuality illegal. I just paused there to give you a moment to pick your jaw up off the floor. The party adopted an official platform in June that keeps a long-held position in support of making homosexual acts illegal. So how long do you think this position has been held? Well, not by the Republican Party. I mean, if you really look at the position that homosexuality should be illegal, it's been held for about the last 5,500 years by every civilization known to man. But it's recently been thrown overboard in the last 30 years. But it has been thrown overboard in the past by other governments. I mean, Greece comes to mind, Rome. And if I'm not mistaken, once they legalized homosexuality, let's just say it wasn't at the peak, at the apex of their global domination, if I'm not mistaken. But you can double-check me on that. I could be wrong. to see Stephen Colbert's research staff going to check me out on that to make sure I'm right. Anyway, the GOP members there in Montana, they're exasperated and embarrassed at the idea that conservatives would want homosexuality to be illegal. We've got Senator John Brugman, a Republican from who knows where and who cares in Montana, saying, "You've got to be kidding me," he says. Should this platform plank be taken out? Absolutely. Does anybody think we should be arresting homosexual people? He says, if you take that stand, you really probably shouldn't be in the Republican Party. Now, there's something I can agree with this guy on. That the Republican Party is a bunch of faggot-loving, homo-hugging freaks. And we can't take it anymore because homos make me want to puke, okay? Am I the only one who feels this way? Am I the only one who can stand up and say, well, I know I'm not the only one because I'm stealing that line from Bob Enyard on the air. But homos make me sick, okay? It's disgusting, it's destructive, and the last thing I want my children to do is even know about it. So when something is like that, can't we all agree that it should be a crime? Apparently we can't, and the Republican Party is falling all over themselves to distance themselves with a position that's been held for 6,000 years, that homosexuality is a crime. You see, the GOP, the grand old party, prefers helping homosexuals degrade and destroy themselves by encouraging their self-destructive behavior because it's popular with the liberals that the Republicans want to like them. And it's worth it to the Republicans to throw the homos overboard and let them destroy themselves and say it's okay, because then maybe Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert would invite me on their show if I at least show that I'm tolerant of men defiling and destroying one another. Make me a good Republican. Do I have anything else from this story? Let's see here. Montana Human Rights Network organizer Kim Abbott said that the GOP platform statement does not represent the attitudes of most Montanans. Really? Well, you know what? I bet if you go to Montana, I bet you most people in Montana and pretty much everywhere else would still be disgusted when you actually point out what it is homosexuals do. Instead of calling them gay, if you actually point out what they do to one another, people's faces turn green and they start to get uncomfortable and they want to throw up. And that's because deep down in the conscience that the good Lord gave you, you know that it's a crime. It's not only sick and disgusting, it's destructive and it should be criminal. Okay? And I don't care if I'm ever invited to a Stephen Colbert party or to be interviewed on that other guy's show, whatever his name is. All right, here we go. More from the Culture File. This is from the Associated Press. Paris Hilton, you'll remember we talked about the cocaine that fell out of a purse that she says wasn't hers in Las Vegas. Paris Hilton was sentenced last week to a public caning, after which she held a press conference acknowledging her addiction, begging forgiveness from her fans, and apologizing to her parents for her awful behavior. Wait a minute. I misread that. I'm sorry. That's from the headlines we'd read if America's justice system were functioning file. That's not a real headline. I apologize. The real headline is Paris Hilton made a deal with prosecutors to avoid a felony, even though she's a pathetic cokehead who desperately needs to be punished before she kills herself. So I apologize for misreading that. Let's go now further into Culture File. From TMZ, Lindsay Lohan has opened a crisis pregnancy center and vowed to donate $100,000 to her church's urban outreach ministry. Wait a second. That was from the same file. Actually, Lindsay Lohan has failed a scheduled drug test. And, she faces 30 days in jail because she tested positive for one or more controlled substances. Over the weekend, sources close to Lindsay... I'm not sure what that means. That's someone who has either transmitted herpes to her or someone to whom she has transmitted chlamydia. Sources close to Lindsay, over the weekend, she was saying it was not true, but apparently, late word is that Lindsay has admitted that, yes, she did fail a drug test, but she may still be clinging to the idea that she didn't take drugs. She's just a victim of the system. So there goes Lindsay. One more. Then this is a real headline. George Michael has been sentenced to jail for 8 weeks for smashing his vehicle into a shop while high on marijuana. So I'm leaving Las Vegas, and I sidle up into the bar where I often stop and eat before I get on the plane. And a young lady sits down next to me at the bar, and I had ordered a pizza and a beer. And I'm eating my pizza and a beer, and I'm watching a football game on television. Two college teams I've never heard of. I could not care less. And there was an amazing play. I forget exactly what it was, but it caused everyone in the bar to kind of go, wow. And this young lady immediately, she leans over, and she looks at me, and I look into her eyes, and I immediately know that she is whacked out on drugs, alcohol, or some massive combination of both. And she starts telling me about herself. How she went to a Super Bowl party last year and partied with the New Orleans Saints, and she starts showing me pictures on her iPhone, and I don't want to see it. I really don't care. I'm trying to eat my food, drink my beer, get ready for the flight. She starts telling me how crazy, man. It was crazy. We were partying, man. It was crazy. Look at these pictures. She's got pictures of herself, obviously in a state, a drunken stupor, hanging all over football players, and she's just so proud of herself. Telling me how it was crazy, man. Isn't that amazing? Wow. And then she said, so what do you do? I said, I'm a preacher. And you should have seen the demeanor on this drunken, drug-addled young woman. Her demeanor changed immediately. She put down her iPhone, tried to uncross her eyes, and started telling me how she was a born-again Christian and she's really fallen and slipped and fallen away from God, and she's done a lot of bad things, and she just doesn't know how she can control herself. Anyway, I didn't have an in-depth conversation with her, but I told her, well, just keep in mind that God is watching you, and there's probably things you're doing that you should be embarrassed about, and I hope you don't kill yourself before you come back to God. Okay, have a nice flight. Anyway, how did I get off on that? Oh, we were talking about all these stars. Anyway, so there you have it. Anyway, I invite you to do that. The next time that you're in an airport and some young person is displaying their tattoos and their state of drunkenness and they're kind of yucking it up, and just tell them that you're a preacher. Man, that was really great. Anyway, I think I got her attention. That was pretty cool. All right, so now just a little bit more from the culture file. West Hollywood, California, a group of law enforcement officials, former law enforcement officials, have endorsed a November ballot measure that would legalize marijuana in California. Well, what can you say about that? This is a group, they're supporting Proposition 19. It's former police officers, judges, prosecutors. Well, at least these people will be able to get out of bed and actually go vote for it, so maybe the potheads have a chance out in California. What else do we have? Now, this is just disturbing. Sanford, Florida. A father furious because his 13-year-old daughter, who suffers from cerebral palsy, had been bullied in a public school bus, jumped on the bus and threatened the children, teasing his daughter with violence. He's been arrested. The young girl, who suffers from cerebral palsy, had to be hospitalized because of the stress. Her father was arrested after he stormed on the bus and threatened these punks. Officials say that the little girl was scared to go to school. And they say that something has to be done about school bullying. I say there has to be something done about schools. I can tell you this, in 1978, me and my brother, we didn't have cerebral palsy, but we were scared to go to school too, because it was a living hell, frankly. Anyway, how could you send your daughter with cerebral palsy to a public school? How do you do that? How do you do that? That's child abuse. All right. I can't take it. And so if you're thinking about sending your kids to the public schools, or if you are sending the kids to the public schools, keep in mind that you're sinning against your children and God, and that you will be held responsible on Judgment Day for it. Let's close out from some newspaper in Hoboken, New Jersey. A 49-year-old Hoboken man was arrested last Tuesday after he beat his girlfriend with a cat. Did I read that right? He beat his girlfriend with a cat. The victim told police that they had been dating for 2 years, and he became mad when she didn't call him the night before. When he caught up with her, she told him she no longer wanted to date him. And that's when he picked up the cat and hit her. He hit her with a cat. Yeah. Now, I remember in 1978, I remember telling that little punk in sixth grade that the only thing worse than listening to Kiss was to be hit in the face with a cat. Anyway, here we've got a guy hitting his ex-girlfriend with a cat in reality. According to the Hoboken News, police currently do not know the whereabouts or the condition of the cat, but we certainly hope the cat is in better shape than the adult human beings involved in this story. That's the Worldview for this week, ladies and gentlemen. I will be back with you next week. Lord willing, I want to thank my friends at KGOV.com. Go check them out. Thank my friends at Personhood USA. And, of course, thanks go out to my other brother, Daryl, who makes it all happen here at the Weekly Worldview Studios. I'll be back with you next week. Until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.